Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are. This is Eric, he's the oldest one. The producer who makes it fun, gotta give him the credit. He's good with the edits. He's been the driving force since they begun. Next we got brother Jay. He just the movies that they play. The sip in the middle, Jay is gonna be a little more critical, analytical when he communicates. And lastly we got Drew, the finally family member of this group. He decides if the movie's worth it. Right kind of guy, that's for certain. Three chatty brothers with a family base. Need an excuse to talk away. Dichotomy of personalities. All you really need to do is press play. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies till they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open to that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way.
Hey. Not in a creepy way.
Welcome, this is Eric.
This is brother Jay.
This is Drew.
Tonight, we're going to talk about the 2002 film The Bourne Identity, directed by Doug Liman, who we know from Swingers, Go, Edge of Tomorrow, and in pre-production, Live, Die, Repeat, and Repeat, and The Cannonball Run. So, Brother Jay, is this series on your list? Were you the one that...
Yes.
Excellent. So, take it away, The Bourne Identity.
So, we ran out of Bond films this last recently. And the tradition around our house for New Year's Eve was we always buy really crappy, trashy hors d'oeuvres and make really bad food. And we eat trashy food all day long on New Year's Eve and watch. In the past, we'd watch, you know, Bond films or espionage films, but we ran out of Bond films. So last year, I bought the Bourne collection, which was all of the Bourne movies, which is the four Jason Bourne movies and then the one kind of ancillary movie, the kind of, is it the Jeremy Renner whatever? Yeah, so Drew's looking very dire.
I reject ancillary.
I haven't seen it, so I was only speculating, so I will take correction. But
wasn't he the guy that played Potsy on Happy Days?
Jeremy Renner? I don't know.
Ancillary.
Yes, ancillary.
So, being that boyfriend Jesse had never seen the Bourne films that he recalled, and I hadn't seen them very often. In fact, I think I had only seen them once with the parents at the cabin. So, I really wasn't super familiar, but I liked what I had seen. So, I figured I would just buy the set. And I've seen the first movie now probably three or four times. But the rest of them I'd really only seen once before, so, but never in the theaters.
And when you watched it this time, what did you think of the first one?
Yeah, it was great. It was fine. It's a perfectly fine espionage thriller suspense movie. It's a little dated, but for the most part, I thought it was a good movie.
So, Brother Drew, what's your history with the Bourne series?
My history with Jason Bourne goes all the way back to sixth grade. I found the Bourne Identity book in a bookstore while I was visiting a friend of mine down in Washington, and I read it. So I was still pretty young. I'd moved on from like comic books and choose your own adventure books to Clive Cussler books. And I'd run out of Clive Cussler books, I think. And so I was looking for another book that looked cool. And I saw a book in the store that was written by the same dude who wrote The Holcroft Covenant, which I had listened to from your tapes, Eric. So I gave it a shot. And it was The Bourne Identity. And I loved it. It quickly became my favorite book. I read that. I read the sequel to it, Bourne Supremacy. And that was right around the time that the third book by Robert Ludlum, The Bourne Ultimatum, was about to come out. I remember I ended up buying that book at Costco because it was unavailable at the library. So I ate them up. I loved them all. I loved the character of Jason Bourne. I had been tracking. There had been rumors that The Bourne Identity was in production for probably a decade before it was made. So like in magazines and stuff, there'd be little blurbs about it. So I was trying to pay attention. it started to hit the internet in the early days of the internet that it was coming. I also tracked down the Richard Chamberlain TV miniseries, The Bourne Identity, and watched that.
How was that?
That was a little rough. A little rough, but it was more faithful to the book than these movies are.
Are the, in your estimation, and granted, this is the first movie, so I will ask you just to limit it, the first book to the first movie. Is the book better than the movie? Or is the movie a good extrapolation of the book, with the book being clearly more expansive?
It's completely different things, as it turns out. Completely different. The book is more like hard-boiled espionage. The movie is more action-adventure-y.
Gotcha.
So it's Jason Bourne in the books is older, way more tortured. The only real similarities between the book and the movies are that Jason Bourne is an amnesiac and has a particular set of skills.
They just kind of used it as a template then.
Yeah.
So when you watched the movie for the first time, what was your reaction?
I was very upset. I was extremely upset. Because it was nothing at all about... nothing at all like the book. It's just even the very basic premise of... the forces that were aligning against Jason Bourne are completely different. In the book, Jason Bourne had a nemesis. It was a rival assassin. There's none of that in this movie. This movie is all about government conspiracy. So after I watched the movie the first time in the theater, I was very underwhelmed and annoyed. And really bummed out. But I got over it. Once I got over the fact that it's not going to tell the same story as the book, that it's just completely different things. I watched it again when it came out on video. I enjoyed it a lot more. You know, the names of the characters are the same, but that's about it. So I was able to, the second time, kind of take it more at face value and enjoy it for what it is. And it's a really good, fun action movie. And I think Matt Damon is really good as the lead. And they do a good job of casting the right types of villains in this movie. And there's a ton of villains, from the Conklin character to the Abbott character to even... the assassin that Bourne ends up killing in the field, played by Clive Owen. I mean, all of that is great. So given some time and some perspective and cutting some of the emotional strings I had to the name of the character and the title of the movie, yeah, I actually quite enjoy this. I enjoy this whole series. In fact, I didn't intend to, but I've already watched the first four movies in the series in the past week.
You reminded me of The Holcroft Covenant. The Holcroft Covenant was the first full-length audiobook I owned. And it was, I think, five cassettes that you had to... They had like there's an A-B adapter. So you had to play each side of each cassette twice. Once with the A side, once with the B side. And it was a full cast recording.
Yeah, they were cool.
I loved it. I listened to it a lot because it was my only audiobook. I mean, I had a couple other audiobooks that were abridged versions. I think one was the Howard Cosell autobiography, which was pretty light, but I just devoured it. That was also the time where I had recorded Swimming to Cambodia and Monster in a Box from VHS onto audio tape. And I was listening to those just on repeat. All the time. I love those. So when I go back and watch those movies, I forget there's a whole different experience when it's not just audio. But anyway, back to this. I'm sure about the same time you discovered it, must have been the same time you discovered it, I read at least the first two of the novels. And I know mom just churns through that stuff. So that's kind of up her alley as well. And so I'm sure they were around, but it had been a while, I'm sure. And then when I watched the movie, I don't remember my reaction when I watched it the first time, but after seeing this movie day before yesterday, my notes are, as a standalone movie, is not part of a series, because I don't think I've seen any of the other movies. This movie is salt. It's perfectly fine, but it really does kind of show its age. Just because action movies are, maybe this was the beginning of the action movie change, being from wacky James Bond to a little more realistic, maybe.
It made a crap ton of money.
Oh yeah, it was a popular movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is dated in some. I told Jason to pay particular attention to the sound effects of one of the fight scenes. I don't know if that made it to you too, Eric.
I didn't hear that.
The fight scene in his Paris apartment with the blonde assassin.
It was Batman-y.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great action scene. But yeah, the punches, they sound like pew, pew,
pew. Well, I definitely have some questions. Although I thought this was a good movie. It was fine. Like I said, perfectly fine. It's not any better than Salt.
Well, I had some issues too when I was watching it. I was like, this doesn't... Like, this makes no sense.
Well, and of course, you have to look at things, even though the movie is put out in 2002, this is like 1980s level of security and going from country to country. Like, you can't do this now. Right. Like, and actually, another thing you point out, Drew, you're the one who loves spycraft. And there wasn't a lot of that in this. I mean, there's a little bit, but it was more like like self-defense action sort of stuff.
Well, but he doesn't remember, so
like it was like pre-parkour.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I really loved about the book is he was such a master of spycraft that he could do it even without understanding why he could do it or how he learned it. He could just do it, and it made sense. Yeah, in this movie, he's a like kung fu expert and kind of a tactician.
Yeah, and there is something about, in a book, you're inside the character's head, so you can do a lot more exploring. And in the movie, it just has to be exposition where he tells a couple times, he has the speech of like, I know this and this and this and this. And I don't know why I know these things, but I know them, and now they have to use them.
Yeah, they had to give him the Marie character so that he had someone to talk to.
Oh, for sure.
The subsequent movies, they give Matt Damon a lot more rope to do a lot of nonverbal acting. So he is a lot more inside his head in the movies that follow.
Well, I'm looking forward. Shall we dive into the plot?
Yes.
We open with an Italian fishing boat crew working off the coast of Marseille, France. And they find an unconscious man, Matt Damon, who is one of our heroes in... Not in a creepy way. We know him from Good Will Hunting, The Talent of Mr. Ripley, Dogma, Interstellar, Contagions, Ocean's 11, and Rounders. But he is adrift in the sea with two gunshot wounds in his back. Actually, I thought it was kind of fun when they pulled him out of the water and just dumped him on the boat. Like, what, you've never seen a dead guy before? And then he starts moving like, whoa! They were not gentle when they dumped him on the deck. So, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't know who he is. The skilled doctor on the ship takes out the bullets and also finds, opens up a scar, which is a little weird to do, I guess, but I'm not a boat doctor, I don't know. And he finds this little device that projects the number of a numbered Swiss bank account.
In the book, that was a microfiche.
Ah, yeah, that makes more sense. So we find out that this guy, he doesn't know who he is. He doesn't know anything about this bank in Switzerland. He has, like, skills, but he has some sort of amnesia.
I thought it was really strange that the doctor, once he was alive, that he was like, this is a weird thing, so I'm going to cut it out.
Exactly.
Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. If he thought he was dead, then he was like, oh. But then why would you? Anyway.
Yeah, it just got to, I guess, take it for you know, let the film take you where it wants to, because this is going to be the start of a horror movie where he breaks open that little metal vial and all of a sudden it's the, I forget what it was called in Return of the Living Dead, trioxin or something they called it. that created the zombies. Anyway, so he ends up, they go to port, and the guy gives him, the doctor gives him a couple bucks to get him to Switzerland and wishes him well.
It was so generous of him.
It was.
It was just, I don't know, little things like that. I'm like, what, why?
Yeah, again, in a book, you could explore the doctor's head. Like, why a skilled surgeon is on a fishing boat. But, oh well. Anyway. So, blah, blah, blah. Go to Switzerland. Ends up sleeping on a park bench and gets rousted by some German police officers. And he doesn't have any ID.
They were probably Swiss.
Oh, you're probably right.
They were speaking really poor German.
Yeah, you're right. They were probably Swiss. Jesus. I'm an American. I don't know anything. It's all one thing.
I mean, over. I don't live there. I'm Brexit, just baby. Assume.
Yeah. So anyway, he beats up some Swiss policeman to evade being arrested.
He disables him with pretty quick dispatch.
Yes, he does. Yes, and he keeps throwing his guns away, which in a video game you never would do. Like, if you're in a video game, he would have had 9 guns in his pocket when he walked into the bank. I guess that wouldn't be a good idea, walking to a bank with 9 guns. But again, Switzerland, who knows? So he ends up opening up his safe deposit box or whatever and finds a whole bunch of passports and money and a gun. And so it's like, oh, he's in some deep shit. But again, he doesn't remember.
Yeah, they're all his passports.
Yes, yes, from different aliases. Mm-hmm. So
different countries of origin and different... Yeah, different places.
So he decides to go to the U.S. consulate. And is it clear what he's trying to do at the U.S. consulate?
I don't think he was originally planning to go there, right? He picked up a tail when he was leaving the bank.
It was his way to escape the security agents that were tailing him from the bank.
Oh, okay.
And I think, you know, for whatever reason in his spy brain, he was like, well... I'm going to go to the embassy because they know they can't touch me. They're embassy is sacred, so they can't penetrate that without some diplomatic coverage.
So inside the embassy, he sees a woman named Marie, played by Franca Potente. Run, Lola, run. And he causes quite a scene.
And the shield.
Oh, is she on the shield?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. She's great. Have you seen Run, Lola, Run lately?
No.
Couple of years ago.
It's different than I remembered. It's got this time loop element to it, but it's fun. Anyway, and there's also some interesting animation in it.
Yeah, and music.
Yeah, music is all, yeah, it's all about music, animation, and it moves fast. It moves real fast.
It's very German.
Is it a German movie? I guess it must have been. Yeah. It's not an English language movie, so. It could be Swiss. I don't know. Clearly.
I'll say it was Swiss.
Yeah. So he causes quite a scene at the U.S. consulate and ends up having to flee the consulate. So now he's on the run from the U.S. and the German police. Or, sorry, Swiss police. But he ends up with his bag of money and he offers Marie $20,000 to drive him to Paris.
Well, $10,000 at first.
Yeah, well, she's no dummy. And she's kind of a sketchy character. In the plot synopsis I stole from IMDb, they describe her as an actual gypsy, but I just think she was like a vagabond.
You're really splitting hairs at that point.
Well, no, but I mean, I don't think she's culturally gypsy. I think she just doesn't...
Splitting German greasy hairs.
Maybe Swiss. We don't know. Maybe French. We don't know that either.
Yeah. Well, except we establish later in the movie that her German's good, but her French is shit.
Ah, well, there you go.
That's one of the big... changes that really bothered me the first time I watched the movie is because I really loved the Marie character in the book. She was completely different. She was French Canadian in the book. She was super smart. She was a economics professor.
So she wasn't damsel in distress.
She wasn't like a street ruffian.
Correct. And even though she didn't have the street smarts, she ended up, you know, still being pretty fierce.
Because Marie ends up being damseled, pretty much.
Yeah, Marie isn't fierce.
She's clever.
Post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, yeah. No, she's fine. I mean, again, I enjoyed her performance, but her character wasn't, she was not on Bourne's level as far as anything.
No.
She was basically following along.
Yeah, and her primary purpose was to give him somebody to talk to.
I think you're right. And back at CIA headquarters, we meet Alexander Conklin, Chris Cooper, also beloved from Capote and the Town.
And Breach.
Breach, yeah.
Forgot all about Breach. My goodness. That's when we're approaching 300, that's when I end up forgetting that we've covered some movies. We're going to eventually do a podcast about a movie that we've covered that none of us will remember having covered.
Oh?
Oh, I'm sure at some point.
Oh. Oh, I thought you had something more specific already.
Oh, no. Also, looking through IMDb to see the credits for everybody, and the next one is a good one, too. We're never going to run out of movies. There's plenty of movies we can talk about from any of these guys, actually.
Oh, yeah.
So, anyway, so Conklin, Chris Cooper, is the head of... By the way, Chris Cooper is great, as usual.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the head of Treadstone, and it's some sort of CIA off-the-books kind of group or whatever. And his supervisor is Ward Abbott, played by Brian Cox from Manhunter, The Long Kiss Goodnight, Zodiac, and Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Turns out Bourne was on a mission to assassinate exiled African dictator Wambasi, played by a very skilled actor whose name I will not try to pronounce. But I will mention that
Adebisi from Oz.
Oh, yeah, well, also, he was supposed to be the Black Panther when they first had like a script in 2009.
Oh.
But, you know, by 2014 or whenever it was, he'd been replaced. So that's very sad. It's all timing. So he is an over-the-top Eddie Murphy caricature of a African dictator. Not necessarily by over-the-top Eddie Murphy performance. I'm not saying not possibly true to life, because some of those African dictators were pretty colorful.
He had been a CIA-backed dictator, right?
Yes.
Had been overthrown. And he was threatening to spill the beans about CIA's involvement in Africa unless the U.S. government put their resources behind reinstating him.
Yes, and he had proof because the U.S. government had tried to assassinate him. So he actually becomes a problem because we learn that Bourne was sent to assassinate him, and for reasons we don't know, that didn't happen. Neither does the CIA. They don't know what happened either. He is presumed to be dead, but then when he shows up at the bank and the bank tips off them, and you know, it's a race then to find Bourne and figure out what he's up to.
Conklin, the character played by Chris Cooper, he immediately thinks Bourne has turned and gone rogue and just wants to kill him.
Yes. And Cox wants the problem solved and doesn't want to know anything about it. And apparently has been giving Conklin problems to solve and hasn't asked any questions before, because they've been pretty efficient, this whole program.
I like the interactions between those two, because they're both really good at the bureaucratic non-speak.
Yes. Yeah, they want deniability.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find out that they decide to send three highly trained assets to eliminate Bourne. And Bourne and Marie go to his apartment in Paris. He finds out he has an apartment in Paris that's registered. I guess it's registered to Jason Bourne, but apparently another of his aliases was supposed to be in a hotel. And they call the hotel and find out that he had died. They give him a death notification by phone from a hotel clerk. Like, well, maybe manager. Still, I don't think I'd be doing that if I was a hotel manager.
We're sorry, sir. He died.
Yeah, I hate to. Didn't you hear? Anyway, he goes back to the apartment, and we find out that... And by the way, I was watching this at work during my lunch hour. I had turned off the lights in the break room. So there's still some light coming like through the blinds and the window. But I was watching it on my iPod, and I had my hands kind of around it, sort of shielding it from light, and my headphones on. It was pretty loud because it's an action movie. And this part... When Castle or Castell, whatever, Nicky Nod, when he comes through that window, I actually jumped. It was a nice little piece of business where they're going around the apartment, and he, you know, Bourne is looking around, and it's all very quiet. And I was not expecting that jump scare. I should have been, but no, it worked.
You didn't see that one coming like 1,000 yards away?
I knew it was coming. I just didn't. I don't know. I thought they did it well as far as timing.
I had not remembered that he came crashing into the window like that.
Yeah, it was. And again, maybe it was part of the noise factor, but it got me. It was great. I was like,
I was so offended when he dropped the knife into the floor that the crashing through didn't affect me.
Yeah, there was a little bit of business where Bourne maybe thought that Marie was going to be a problem. And so potentially he was going to go kill her. Is that what that was all about?
No, that's not what I got at all.
Oh.
I got that he, his like spidey sense was tingling and he thought something was up.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
Oh.
So he was preparing himself for a fight.
So he dropped the knife in the floor not so as not to alarm her?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Not to hide the fact that he was coming at her with a knife.
You were watching a much darker movie than I was.
Well, I was startled. What can you say? So then we have what is kind of cartoony, especially since we've seen better fight scenes in more recent movies. But this was a fun fight scene. It was, again, it's kind of cartoonish.
It starts an awesome tradition of Jason Bourne fighting with improvised weapons.
Yeah, which is good. I mean, that's mm-hmm. his character trait, so that actually works well.
Yeah, so he fights him off with a pen. But if you have the ability, it might be entertaining for our listeners. I can't even say mom anymore, right? She stopped listening?
Oh, I think she might be back on the wagon here pretty soon.
It might be entertaining for them if you have the time and or ability to just put in an audio clip of the fight. Because the sound effects are extremely dated.
Sweet. Well, here it is now.
God damn, the big pen. That was the best thing ever.
Oh, yeah. No, it was good. I mean, you're right. Improvised weapons is a clever thing. Again, because the guy doesn't know how to retain a gun. He just drops them everywhere.
It's one of my favorite running gags in the series.
It was the pen?
It gets better. Like each movie.
Okay. Well, I can't wait. So then, here's where I have my first question. The rest of the movie... you know, which we will talk about. The rest of the movie kind of goes along in a pretty standard way. But please tell me that Julia Stiles' character shows up in the next movie prominently. Because what the hell is she doing in this movie? Her character is unnecessary. You don't think so? Okay, you can't.
I don't want to spoil it.
She must be an important character, though, right?
Let me reframe this. Why is Julia Stiles famous?
She was in 10 Things I Hate About You.
Is that it?
Yeah, pretty much. And she's been a bunch of stuff at that time, too. A bunch of, like, indie movies and a couple horror movies, I think, maybe. And I think she's done some TV lately, too.
All right. I mean, I knew who she was, but I couldn't tell you why I knew who she was.
She was one of that group of teens back then. In the Heath Ledger times.
I didn't know anything about her.
Like Rachel Lee Cook was in the same class, I think.
I don't even know who that
even,
is.
Now I'm going to forget her name. Sharknado. Choke.
Tara Reid?
Tara Reid, yeah. I think maybe back in that time. Pretty much everybody who was in that Josie and the Pussycats period of movies. 10 Things I Hate About You, that Not Another Teen Movie era. I think that's what, if in listeners, maybe perhaps just Dougie at this point, really, has any insight into who the hell Julia Stiles is and what happened to her career. Now I'm thinking, of course, she didn't have sex with Harvey Weinstein. That's why she's not like a name star now.
Ooh.
It's all very sad. But Yeah, what her character in the, because again, I only have this movie to go with. I'm blind from the next movies because if I've seen them, I don't remember any of them. But the fact that she is a named character in this and pops up a couple of different times means she's got to be important in some way, but she is useless in this movie. The brother, the stepbrother, whatever, played by Tim Dutton, who is not Timothy Dutton.
The stepbrother?
Yeah, whatever.
Murray's brother.
Brother.
With the kids.
Something. Some relative.
Eamon? The farmhouse?
Yeah, Eamon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's more integral to this movie than she is.
I never got that was her brother.
Yeah, I don't know if it really is or not, but
I thought that was like an ex.
They threw the details really fast in why they came to that house. Like how the CIA found out that she could go to that house. Tradecraft.
I don't know. I did not have that feeling about the Nikki character. I mean, she was the handler in Paris.
But she does nothing. She's a secretary who listens to a scanner.
She gives transitions, though.
Yeah, I suppose. You're right. She gets us from scene to scene.
Also, there's no way to introduce the office, really, that she's in for the final big scene if there's no establishment of the office.
I guess. But during that final scene when she's in, she adds nothing to the scene, either. I mean, we'll get there, but yeah, anyway, so I don't understand why she's even in this movie, but that's fine. So we've got this Wambasi character, and Bourne has figured out that that's who he was supposed to kill, so he's going to go down and talk to him, I guess, or something, but unfortunately...
Yeah, I mean, at this point, he's just trying to retrace his steps to see if anything triggers a memory.
So... we have the second asset, codenamed the Professor, Clive Owen, of Children of Men, and a bunch of movies we have not covered. But I was thinking to myself, why isn't Clive Owen like a name guy now? Like he's legitimately charismatic in this movie. He's great in everything I've seen. I think it's because he has the ability to be like the cold assassin. But also he can turn his face to weight of the world sort of pathetic guy at the same time. You know, pre-shot, post-shot.
I still think about him every time I listen to music too loud in my car and yes. My ears ring afterwards. Uh-huh. That's the sound of that frequency dying. I will never hear that frequency again.
Yes.
Oh, see, all we have to do is review Gosford Park.
I love Gosford Park. I had to watch the subtitles, but yeah, it should be on the calendar. I loved it.
Yeah, it was a good movie too.
There's a meme that I don't know if Drew's seen, but that's going around that it's a pie chart, and it shows it says the pie chart is labeled "Reasons I Use Subtitles," and there's a very small slice of the pie that says "Foreign Language Film." There's a slightly bigger slice of the pie that says "Strong Accents." And then the majority of the pie is because I'm going to be eating chips. Someone with misophonia can appreciate the fact that you turn the subtitles on so that you can't.
Clive Owen was uncredited in the Pink Panther movie in 2006.
I bet you Steve Martin wished he was uncredited in that movie.
He was in Sin City.
Oh, yeah. No, he was great in Sin City. Which turns out doesn't hold up.
No.
It's better than the second one, but it doesn't hold up. I thought it was so good at the time. I was such a big Robert Rodriguez fan.
There were a bunch of short films he was in. Ambush, Chosen, The Follow, Star, and Powder Keg, where he was all listed as the driver.
Oh, those are ads.
Are they?
Yeah.
Oh, it just says short in IMDb. I'm not familiar with them.
Yeah, they were like Mercedes ads or something.
Like long-form advertisements become short-form films?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's back around the time everybody thought he was going to be the next James Bond.
Yeah. He would have been a great Bond. Did Pierce Brosnan get in the way? Was that why? Or was it Daniel Craig? Yeah. Well, it's hard to argue that Daniel Craig wasn't good because he's one of the best Bonds, I think.
Clive Owen was in this really bizarre movie I watched where he was like a retired gangster who came out of retirement to track down the dude that raped his brother and caused his brother to kill himself.
Wow, that's kind of dark.
Malcolm McDowell, I think, was the rapist. And his brother was...
I love Malcolm McDowell.
His brother was the actor who played Henry VIII in The Tudors, Jonathan Rhys Meyers.
Oh, yeah, okay. So, no, I'm a big fan of Clive Owen. We can definitely watch more Clive Owen movies. Gosford Park has to be on the list at some point.
Gosford Park's a great movie.
Yeah. So, we end up... The professor has actually already killed Wambasi. So, Bourne and Marie then flee, and they go to the home of her, it says in the notes, stepbrother, whoever, Eamon, played by Tim Dutton. Again, not Timothy Dutton. And they're in the countryside, blah, blah, blah. But unfortunately, Tim there has his kids there. Apparently, this might be a second home or something. And they're intending to just kind of break in and spend the night. But he blows the plan by showing up. But it worked out well because the kids and the dog and everything allow them to get wind of the assassin before he strikes. And this is the point where Bourne becomes like sort of autistic savant guy.
He's like programmed soldier at this mode.
Yeah, yeah. He's kind of ignoring a certain amount of his own personal safety, or at least he's very rigid, let's say.
Yeah, I really like this aspect of Matt Damon's performance with Jason Bourne, because he is so confident in how competent he is that he is super calm in these situations.
Yeah, he's fed up, like, basically.
Yeah, he walks when he needs to walk. He runs when he needs to run, but he's never frantic, and he's always really calculating. It's like the Michael Mann thing, that it's always fun. It's always entertaining watching people do things that they're really good at doing, whatever that thing is.
I think we can all agree. Then we have this the scene in the field, which I thought was kind of a brutally effective scene, where Bourne is facing somebody who is just like Bourne. Mm-hmm. And the guy, Clive Owen, is sort of fascinated. Like, oh, which one are you? You must be Paris, or who are you, Milan? like I don't know who you are, but you're good. Respect your skills.
Yeah, just that brief dialogue that they have right at the end. I really love the writing here, because just those couple lines, it takes it from what's a really contained, narrow movie to just, in your imagination, it opens up this whole universe of, this assassin's guild out there.
Yeah. And it takes a scene where Clive Owen knows he's going to be killed. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't make him pathetic. And it doesn't, it's not there to tweak your heartstrings.
Right.
It's just there. You have these two professionals who are conducting business, and at the end of business, one of them is going to get the business.
And not to spoil anything, but what Clive Owen says, what the professor says to Jason Bourne right there, that is echoed in a later movie.
Okay.
All right. It's important.
Okay. Good to know. Then Bourne ends up calling Conkling and basically says, look, I'm done. I'm out of this. And let's see, blah, blah, blah. We have this, I guess, setup where he kind of tries to, or he pretends to blackmail Conkling into that he's going to turn himself in or whatever. But he's just observing, and that's way he can get the drop on him. So there's some spycraft there, too. And there's actually some fairly good car chases in the movie.
Yeah, very... very amazing aerodynamics and physics at play in the little crappy Austin Mini Cooper.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's good, though. It's fun. Like, I think I remember it being... I remember the scene of them going down the stairs as being very impressive at the time.
Yeah, it was... It was fun. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. So, and then we have the scene in the Treadstone Julia Stiles building. And
her name is Nikki Parsons, Eric.
Sorry. Nikki Parsons, named character. During this fight, she does not pick up a weapon. She does not. She basically just kind of hangs around in the background, hoping not to get her suit, like, mussed with blood or something.
She's Jason Bourne's handler. She knows.
I guess. I don't know.
You don't point a gun at Jason Bourne. You're going to end up with your arm, like, bent the wrong way.
Yeah. Yeah. But shouldn't, I mean, like, so Bourne doesn't know that she's his handler, I guess, right?
Yeah, it's even worse, right?
Or maybe maybe he's only after Conklin and doesn't. Well, no, because the guys that come after him, they get the business too.
Yeah, why? Because they're shooting at him.
So you're saying it's fair?
Nikki's the smartest one there.
Yeah, she deliberately stands down.
Okay, well, I guess I'm prepared to be impressed with her next movie.
But she also makes the point repeatedly, like, she's not equipped for any of this. She's just kind of a field agent. She's not.
Yeah, she's a secretary.
She just keep in the office.
Yeah. Yeah. What is she, Fawn Hall?
Because she's. It's like a 1% reference.
That's a deep, deep pull.
Oh, you know, feeling nostalgic. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. Conklin ends up getting taken out by that third asset known as Mannheim, played by Russell Levy.
You're skipping the part where Jason Bourne rides a man?
Well, there's
down,
that, yes.
Down the middle of a flight of stairs?
After the man is shooting in the air at the bottom of the lobby up, like he's going to accomplish anything by that?
It's a pretty serious action piece at the end, sure. In the theater, I'm sure it was one of those things where the crowd is like, yay! Or something.
I did that at home.
Yeah. So, I am yada-yadaing the final action scene.
Which was awesome.
Okay. And Conklin ends up getting taken out. Turns out, through the orders of Brian Cox.
Yep.
And that was the third asset, right?
Yes.
Who did that?
Yep. Mannheim. So at some point we flash to some sort of congressional subcommittee, probably the intelligence committee, I'm guessing, where he's saying that, no, it turns out that Operation Treadstone thing was more of a computer simulation or something. Didn't really work out well. But let me tell you about this new program, Operation Blackbriar. So I imagine that's going to be an issue in the next movie.
You think?
Yeah, I guess. And so it turns out that Marie has ended up in Mykonos with Balki Bartholomus.
Mm-hmm.
And she runs some sort of surf scooter rental place.
Where there's apparently porpoises or dolphins near.
She turned his red money bag into a flower pot.
I noticed that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cute.
I like the red money bag, actually. It was just kind of a weird touch, but it was a nice visual thing. And yeah, so they have an embrace, and it fades to black. Or actually, maybe it fades to the Brian Cox scene at the Senate committee. But either way, everybody's happy. End of movie. Done. As a standalone movie at that point.
And that music at the
Moby.
End.
Oh, is it Moby?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. It felt very retro, like 70s thriller.
That's a great Moby song.
I'm kind of a Moby fan.
I dig Moby, so.
This movie did not hook me with its music.
I mean, he probably smells bad and he's kind of crazy sometimes, but yeah, I like his music.
Smells like vitamins and vegetables.
No, but just that opening, like that shrill opening to that
the
song.
Stabs, the orchestral stabs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Love it. It's such an audio trigger.
So it gave you what you want.
Yeah.
What you really, really want. So I only have one more thing of notes, and it was nice to see Walton Goggins. Or was it Walter Goggins?
Yeah, that was still back when he had a forehead before he had a five head.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, people change, feelings change. So, any other notes, Jason?
Yeah. So I thought it was a nice touch how he off and on had the sweater with the bullet holes in it. That seemed to make an appearance off and on throughout the movie.
Was it? It was the same sweater.
Well, it had holes in the same place where he was shot. So,
well, okay.
There's a fingerprint scanner at the bank. I was like, "Ooh, that's a little bit of a throwback."
In 2002, that was high tech.
And she offers him $10,000 to drive to Paris, which is a lot of money still, but a lot of money then.
Oh yeah.
So. She doesn't like, Marie doesn't like or trust his amnesia, which is understandable. They punish that Mini Cooper beyond, I'm sure, what was actually even practical. And in the flat, when they go back to his flat in Paris.
That's another Bourne trademark, by the way.
Destroying cars?
Yes.
She's using a toothbrush. Whose toothbrush is it?
She rides rough, Marie does.
really just... It took me out of the movie for a few minutes. I had to pause because I was like,
ooh. Because you're like, ooh. Otherwise.
It would not surprise me at all that she carried everything she owned with her everywhere she went.
Yeah. Well, and also it wouldn't have surprised me in that place if the toothbrush had been individually wrapped in cellophane because everything else in that place was immaculate.
Yeah. That was like a Neil McCauley apartment.
Yes.
And then I thought when he's trying to get the invoice from the hotel and he's trying to set up this huge elaborate set of circumstances so that he can manage to get the invoice. And then she just walks in and asks for it.
That's beautiful.
And yeah, it was awesome. I was like, that's
some Indiana good... Jones.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like it.
I remember when I first saw this movie and the reveal of the reason why he couldn't finish the assassination was the kid in Wombosi's lap. That made me gasp out loud. So,
well, see, I saw another movie this week that had similar things in it. So we'll talk about that eventually. But
and then they have that dramatic. He has that dramatic crisis where he's like, "I don't care who I am anymore."
Yeah.
Let's see what else. Yeah, I wrote, gee, the office girl isn't much of an agent, but they keep referring to Bourne as a malfunctioning $30 million weapon. They seem really intent to tout that.
Yeah, how is he worth $30 million?
I think that's what they invest in him to create him.
That's a lot. That seems like an unwise investment.
No, he's told. He's told by the boss. Like, I don't send
worth
you
every penny.
I don't send you to kill. I send you to be invisible, which is like, ooh.
Yeah, you know, I thought that the speech at the end, where their dialogue at the end, shows that that Chris Cooper, the Conklin character, he's a bad guy, but he's just a bad guy in a bureaucratic way. He just has a job to do.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, Bourne has screwed up this thing and he's got to clean it up and he's not necessarily very happy about it. But it's not like he's a super villain or anything. No? Drew is smiling, which does not reflect well on the podcast. You think I'm too sympathetic to...
to the bureaucrat?
Yeah.
His tragic flaw was that he was unable to open his mind to other possibilities, right?
I guess.
Yes.
He leapt to the simplest conclusion when his life could have been much simpler if he just kept an open mind and didn't try to solve every problem with the back of a frying pan.
Yeah, he makes no attempt to actually do any reconnaissance and find out what happened. He just assumes that since Bourne fucked up, like, well, we'll just eliminate him. But then makes a point of like, your $30 million weapon. Like, why would you get rid of that investment? Like, wouldn't you want to know what had happened and what went wrong? Except that immediately he goes into cover his own ass mode. And then the only way to kind of perpetuate his momentum and keep going is to say, well, Bourne's gone rogue. And then he frames him for, you know, killing Wombosi to justify even more. And so it just kind of furthers that.
Well, okay. But from my perspective, he doesn't know what happened to Bourne, right?
Right.
Like you don't want to keep your mind open to like alien abduction, do you? I mean, that's about as believable as he has temporary amnesia, he has retrograde amnesia, and he was just trying to do his job. Also, framing him for killing Wombosi is it's bad. I mean, it means that he has to run harder. But since he was hired to kill Wombosi anyway, it's not, you know. I mean, Jason Bourne is not a good guy.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe
he's an assassin. Jason Bourne is.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. He was killing people with abandon, so.
Yeah. So.
No, I get that the nature of his job and his position is to not trust people.
Yeah.
And to think the worst. But given the $30 million investment that they keep talking about, given how dangerous he is, he didn't even try to formulate any sort of plan to try and bring him in.
Well, but see, he's not unique. He was just Paris. They had a whole Rolodex full of people. By the way, if you're listening, Rolodex is like a card system of filing. Right now, we use a database, you know, but Rolodex was like sitting on a desk. Anyway, no, he had a whole file full of other assassins. I mean, he wasn't. He had Paris. He had the professor. He had all. I mean, there were theoretically dozens of these guys. So just using them to take out the one rogue one seemed like the most efficient way of solving that problem. You don't really care why. I mean, I guess if you can get him into a room and pluck out his fingernails and find out why, that'd be fine. But you're still going to dump him in the ravine when it's all over.
You really think a super weapon that you've dumped $30 million into is going to give up secrets by tearing out his fingernails?
I don't believe they spent $30 million on him. I don't get it. I don't understand. That's all. I mean, maybe
if you torture him, he's just going to take that chunk of metal that you left in his side and use it to escape.
He may, very well may. But yeah, that's fine. I mean, I'm happy to go on the ride. I'm just saying that I actually had a little sympathy for Conklin at the end. He's just doing his job, man. He knew it.
Yeah, you know, Darth Vader turned out to be a good guy, too.
Wow.
No. Darth Vader killed the younglings. I will never forgive him. Anyway, any other notes on...
No.
So, Brother Jay, what's your verdict on The Bourne Identity?
This movie is an A movie. You know, it's a little dated, but it's got plenty of action. It's got enough of a plot to allow you to immerse yourself in it without getting too drawn. But I was entertained, and I've seen it twice now in less than 6 months, and I enjoyed it both times. So no, this is a fine popcorn-y flick. So it's not deep. It's not complex. There's a little bit of twisty turny that is interesting. The first time you've seen it, it's okay in subsequent reviews, but no, this is a perfectly fine movie.
Drew, was it worth it?
Absolutely. I feel like perfectly fine is understating it. This movie is awesome. It is so much fun. It moves along really fast. Everybody in this movie seems, especially Julia Stiles, seems like they're having such a great time.
You're just baiting me.
It's really fun to rewatch. It's a little dated, but it's a lot of fun to see such a young Matt Damon. It's kind of crazy to think how close this was to Good Will Hunting. I mean, it's only like what, 4 years later. He's got a lot of he had a couple scenes where he got a little agitated talking to Marie, where he kind of slipped into the Will Hunting accent. I thought he was going to call her Skylar at one point when he was getting upset.
Walk up to the Swiss policeman and ask him how they like those apples.
Exactly. That would have been badass. But no, this movie is so much fun. You know, Chris Cooper and Brian Cox are just chewing up the scenery with their spy talk, their jargon, and their whole language of not ever giving a straight answer. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Like I mentioned before, I was so hyped up after I watched this movie, I immediately started the second one.
Okay. I'm going to say this is a B+ at best. I'm glad you guys enjoyed it so much. I'm hoping for better things in the next movie. I want Julia Stiles to take a knife out of her boot and cut someone. That's all I want. So we'll see.
She cuts with words, Eric.
Yeah, okay. It's not that kind of movie.
She's not equipped for that office.
Exactly.
Words and knowing glances. Those are her weapons.
And sympathetic doe eyes.
Well, okay. And if this group, if Treadstone or whatever was the place I worked, I am Julia Stiles. So I get it. I mean, I just didn't see, they didn't portray her as being very useful.
You are not appreciating the subtleties of her performance. Did you see how quickly her eyes were darting back and forth between Bourne and Conklin?
I will put a clip of that sound effect if you'd like in the... Oh, dear God. Okay. Okay, so were you on to housekeeping?
You know, she got second billing, don't you?
I did not know. In this movie?
Mm-hmm.
Over Franca Potente?
Yeah.
Huh. Over... Yeah. Okay. All right, fish on. Okay, you know what? I'm disgusted. I'm going to go pee.
Well, that's pretty good. You got him worked up good.
Julia Stiles could have been played, but that character could have been played by Lily Sobieski.
No.
100%.
No. No. You're really selling her performance short.
I am. I am undervaluing it. So, are we on to housekeeping?
Save the Last Dance, Eric.
Okay. All right. Never saw it. May have remembered the poster.
Housekeeping.
Yeah, I want to hear about the nice father, or not father, mother-son time you had this week.
Yeah, no, I'm going to tell you, Drew will appreciate this. I have two stories and a question.
I'll take the answer off the air.
Those are my favorite.
The first thing is at work, we now have a cage in our refrigerator that has certain people's milk in it. You could buy a fridge cage.
I'm going to buy one for my new office.
All I want to do is buy a slightly bigger cage and put the other cage in there.
I think you should put like a hamster in it.
Yeah. Or we're also trying to figure out how to get the milk out with leaving the bottle still in the cage. Yeah.
Syringe.
There will be blood style. I drink your milkshake.
Yeah.
Anyway, the second thing is I watched the movie Polar with Mom on Monday. I actually said,
how did you talk Mom into watching Polar?
I said, Drew said it was great. We're going to watch this movie. and then I told her about the difference between Arctic and Polar, and you know how it was in Mads Mikkelsen. We love him anyway. Jason, you have not seen the movie?
No.
Did you see part of it and decide to bail, or did you?
Yes.
Okay.
You saw the torture scene, right?
Yes.
Oh, you didn't see the beginning?
No.
I thought you would. There's a scene in the beginning which was played for laughs that I thought you would have pulled the plug on, but I won't give it away. If anybody has the ability to see Polar, it's available on United States Netflix now. It is funny, but also like the bloodiest, goriest, silly action movie maybe ever.
Yeah, there's really lowbrow humor in it, and there's really subtle humor in it. Like the interaction between Mads Mikkelsen and his neighbor.
Vanessa Hudgens?
Yes, when they're both like super socially awkward.
I don't think I like the end and how, but I mean, I know why the end is like the end, because it's setting up another movie, and also it's like the whole thing was a graphic novel. Because it definitely has that feel to it.
What was the end that you didn't like?
Okay, if you don't like spoilers, give us 2 minutes. The end is that they basically, she's going to now become an assassin and go after the people that hired him to kill her father.
No.
But other than that, I mean, I thought the acting was way over the top, but really fun because it was way over the top. If they had taken the torture scene with the toenail clippers out, because that was rough to sit there with mom.
Is she okay? Did she survive the movie okay?
Well, we both laughed and said that we're not going to let dad watch the movie.
Yeah. I loved everything, every scene Catherine Winnick was in.
Yes.
She was great.
Yep, I agree.
And don't you think it's worth sitting through the torture scene just to get laser finger guns?
It was maybe because you had told me that you would use the phrase laser finger guns. But I thought laser finger guns was the silliest thing in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like, the lasers did not... I mean, he just basically was, like, flailing his arms around. And they could have just set him on, like a sprinkler mode, and it would have been fine. But, yeah. They were cool.
You're right. The practicality. But it looked badass.
Yeah, it did. It definitely did.
Him and his trench coat and eye patch.
Yeah, he's kind of a badass. I think I didn't like him initially when I saw Casino Royale, because I thought he was kind of like too effeminate to be a legitimately scary guy.
He was bleeding from the eye. How is that effeminate?
No. He had this European thing about him.
Apparently we bring our own baggage on these trips. Good Lord.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, but he was wiping it with a really, really lame handkerchief.
Yeah.
It's like you have blood on your pocket square.
Yeah.
Badass villain.
Exactly. But I have renewed respect for... Actually, as Hannibal, he's pretty menacing.
Yes.
But also, in this movie, he was actually... this movie had a lot like... I mean, the whole thing about the kid. The same plot, pretty much, as Born Identity.
Yeah. Also, if you're a dog lover, this movie is...
that's what I was... Actually...
It takes a hard turn.
But it's beautiful, though. It's the funniest... It's one of the funniest gags in the movie.
Yes.
All his pets. But yeah,
I mean, it's such a wild movie because it starts out with the sort of TNA tease and then the really bloody assassin. And then it essentially, assassination. And then it essentially smash cuts to Mads Mikkelsen getting a prostate exam.
Yeah. And all along, you think that he's going to be killing the doctor or whatever. He's just so cold that he like the next sentence he says to everyone could be, and we're done here. And then he shoots you twice in the head and walks out the door. No, I liked it. I thought it was great, but also I would have to be very selective on who I suggested went to see it.
you don't say.
I think the first question you have to ask people is, do you hate Johnny Knoxville?
I got my train of thought back. There's a new thing on Netflix. It's an anthology.
Wait, Johnny Knoxville spurred a thought in your head?
No. Yeah, I remembered what I had.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just wanted to clarify that.
No, I'll get there. Have you seen A Lowdown Dirty Shame? Or maybe it's just called A Dirty Shame. The John Waters movie with Selma Blair and Johnny Knoxville? And no. Tracy Morgan, not Tracy Morgan, Tracy Ullman?
No.
it's actually pretty funny. It's kind of accessible for a John Waters movie, but it's also bizarre like a John Waters movie. So we'll, yeah, at some point, maybe we'll watch A Dirty Shame. But no, there's an anthology series on Netflix called Love, Death, and Robots. Have you heard about
it? I've heard about it.
I have not.
They're all animated things. They are about love, death, and robots, or some combination.
It's apparently a little Lynchian.
The best I can describe it, and this is what brought to mind, is, and all the things range from being like 7 minutes long to like 15 minutes long. So they're all really short. I mean, but I sped through them all in one sitting. I had first decided to just watch a couple that looked interesting. And the first one I watch is a story that I was already familiar with called Beyond the Aquila Rift. It's got like a little Lovecraft thing going on. So I was in to watch that because it'd be interesting to see the animation there. And the animation styles are slightly different. They're not, you know, it's not wildly different between all of the episodes, but they're, you know, different styles of animation a little bit. And you get the idea that it's like a heavy metal kind of thing where they have the ability to swear and show boobs, so they do. So there's lots of swearing and boobs. But it's not about that, which is what, you know, Polar also went over the top with swearing and boobs and blood. So, you know, Love, Death, and Robots is sort of the same. But I really liked it. I liked every single one of the shorts. I mean, some were better than others, but I think actually Beyond the Aquila Rift was the least impressive because maybe I knew the story. So, which leads me, not in a good segue, but just happens to lead me, to the question I have. And it's one of those deep Anderson family questions, so buckle up. Here's the question I have for each of you.
I'm not going to cry, am I?
You might, but no, I don't think so. We'll find out.
I don't know. It's a pretty low threshold these days.
You never know, right? So, right now, today, 2019, in the comfort of your own homes, because we each have our own homes, how often do you use a bath towel before you throw it in the washer?
One time.
Drew?
7 times.
I think I am programmed that 7 days would be the minimum amount of time I could use that towel. That towel will never hit the floor for a solid week before I would even, unless I bled on it or I used it to clean up like stuff. If it was just used to dry me after the shower, it's not even one of those things like the fact that I use paper towels and sometimes I'll use 2 paper towels and laugh because I have the freedom to use 2 paper towels or to use paper plates for just whatever I want to or use a regular plate. Doesn't matter to me. I can use 3 knives to make 1 sandwich if I want. That's the thing I have joy in as an adult.
That way you keep crumbs out of the butter.
Yeah, but growing up, if you did not use the same knife, as Drew would call it, a chokeable offense. But so my wife finds it horrifying that I don't change my bath towel out more regularly. She's like, it's full of dead skin and stuff. I'm like, the world is full of dead skin. I can't take a towel. I have a hard time at a hotel using a towel and like throwing it on the in the tub or whatever, so they'll take them away.
You mean the quarter towel that barely will dry your arm?
Well, I have a system where I tie hand towels together.
I see. Yeah. So
you were conditioned to this.
Were growing you not? Up in the...
No.
Yeah, we were shamed into it.
I was totally conditioned into it.
Yeah, we were totally shamed.
My memory was that our father took a shower every night.
Yes.
And used a fresh set of towels every night.
Okay, you lived upstairs where he lived.
Yes.
Yes.
We were not given the freedom downstairs to use towels every night. It would have been horrifying. If he would have found out that we would have taken like dried our body once and thrown the towel on the floor, we would have had to hide in the woods.
Even though that's what he did.
Doesn't matter. There's so many things that he did. He would tell us as he was scolding us, do as I say, not as I do.
Yes.
I teach by bad example. I've used these lines with my own child.
That's funny. I, I wasn't similarly conditioned as you were, but I do remember. I remember very clearly having a conversation with you. I thought it was bonkers that you didn't get a new towel. This is when we lived in the house together. That you didn't get a new towel every time. And you were like, that was maybe back when you were a little bit more smug and condescending to me than you are now. Your response was, I guess we could say, very Socratic.
Oh no!
You were like, why would I need a new towel every time? And I was like, because it's gross. You're like, why is it gross? Oh, because it's dirty. You're like, why is it dirty? It's not dirty. I just use it to dry off my clean body. I just got out of the shower. Why is it dirty? You know, and you know, you were 7 years older than me, so you know, my response was like, I don't know, whatever. that always stuck with me. It's like, oh, that actually makes a lot of sense. Why would you need a brand new towel every time? Because you are just drying off your clean body.
The smugness was because it was the only way to keep my eye from twitching.
So that always stuck with me. So now that I have my own household, it's just logical. Like, why would you need a new towel every time? I have sort of a weekly laundry cycle. So when I do laundry, you know, once a week, towel goes in, I get a new towel, and it hangs up for a week until the next laundry cycle. It seems very fine and civilized.
The reason I was so anxious as a child to learn how to do my own laundry so I could have a goddamn fresh towel whenever I wanted it. Because I would throw the towels in with my clothes and was like, oh, I don't want to waste all the water and detergent, so I'll just wash it all in once. And that way, you know, I don't get yelled at because I'm being efficient and I'm not being wasteful. But when you live in some place, hang on, when you live in some place such as Oregon or Alabama, where it is a high humidity environment, you cannot hang a towel up and reuse it anyway, because it will not become dry. Also, because it is so wet, it will actually start to breed things like mold and bacteria. So there is no way living in Oregon I would ever reuse a towel, because it's actually how you get infections.
There is no indication that I am not getting infections by these towels. Because remember, I live in the swamp. But yeah, I asked Kelly, the whole thing that prompted this is I asked Kelly the other night, like offhandedly, hey, can I grab a towel to use downstairs? Like, because I have my own bathroom too. So it's like the girls' bathroom is one place and I have my own bathroom. And so I'm like, hey, can I use one of the towels, you know, to replace my own? She's like, yeah. What? You need to replace your towel more often. I'm like, no, it's fine. She goes, I don't understand it. It is gross. I'm like, it's not gross. In fact, let me get on my high horse and explain that it's the cleanest. And immediately, as my
eye was... Why is it gross?
Again, my eye was twitching, and I'm like, I've got to write down towel to talk about on the podcast. Because I'm sure there are a million things, like using too many knives and the towel, that it's crazy.
Rinsing the Kool-Aid packet to get every last molecule of flavor out.
I don't do that, but I can see its value.
I still get anxious if I heat up an ice cream scoop under hot water. Because yeah. I remember being lectured about my $500 bowl of ice cream.
What?
Oh, of course.
Really?
No, I take long showers. Oh. See, the thing is, the towel thing is like, I don't even think about it. It's just so programmed. But I take long showers when I want to, just to defy, just to be like, what would Dan Brownfield think now? No one's going to kick a ball at the door in my bedroom or in my house and tell me not to keep using all the hot water.
I've walked into their house and every television set, without exception, every television set in that house is on.
Do as I say, not as I do.
I know. I'm just saying. Like, okay.
Yeah, you can't take a long shower, but Dad can just let it rain in his garage for hours.
But yeah, so towels. That was my question. It's like, I remember, fondly from my youth, I remember towels because of The Hitchhiker's Guide from the Galaxy, which I fell in love with at the right age. Apparently, if you miss that window where sarcasm is funny, you're not a big Hitchhiker's Guide fan, but I will forever be. Using one towel per wash, like, oh, I'm not a monster.
Whatever, Rockefeller, go get your new towel.
Exactly, yeah.
Apparently, I'm a monster.
How often do you do laundry? How many towels can a family have?
I have 14 towels. Okay. I do towels once a week.
Well, I mean, I have probably 14 pair of underwear.
Please tell towels. Me you change those every day.
I do, yeah.
Okay.
Hey, I'm getting older. Sometimes I change them more than once a day. But, you know.
Turn them inside out.
Hey, they ain't no $35 pair of MeUndies either. Can't afford that kind of stuff. Again, our father wishes he grew up in the Depression. That was my assessment, which is going to sound harsh, so I'll probably take it out of this podcast now, but just so you guys have heard it. It's like, yeah, cause I don't know. Does everybody here have a bucket of nuts and bolts and screws?
Yeah, but he got that.
I think probably the better question is, if you have a leftover screw from something, do you ever throw it away?
Oh, never. Right. Yeah. It should go actually in a bucket that has a towel in it and then a bunch of screws, so you can take the towel out and spread it out and look for all the screws. And then, yeah. They don't even make coffee cans anymore, but goddammit, I have a coffee can.
Well, he got that from his dad. So.
Oh, I know. And they grew up not having a lot of money, so I get that. But that's the thing, is I have a bucket full of washers, but only one towel.
How often do you wash the towel in the coffee can?
Never. Not that one. That's the screw towel.
I still have a box with various lengths of telephone cords.
Yes, I am actually right now, I am divesting myself from those.
I have a duffel bag full of cords and cables.
Yes, yes.
From peripherals that I don't have anymore.
Yep, coaxial cables.
RCA cables, stereo cables.
Adapters.
Adapters, cables, patch cords.
Serial cords. S cables for foreign televisions.
I have a crimping tool to make my own coaxial cables.
Yes.
Coaxial cables.
Oh, yes.
And I have a crimping tool to make phone cords.
Me too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And a coil, so I can make Cat 5 cables as well.
Absolutely. As every boy should. Yeah. Oh, well. But again, that's the thing. So all of those quirks that I blame my father for passing on to me, I'm sure he got from his father. Who got them from his father before?
Well, the great irony about the towel thing is I learned that from you.
Well, exactly.
Because apparently I lived in the penthouse favorite son status.
So you had the golden bathroom.
I never got the towel shaming.
Yeah. No, you lived in the upstairs where you had the bathroom that was used by the good people.
Yeah, you didn't have to bathe downstairs with the oddly handled shower that you had to push the red anti-scald button in, which could then scald you to get any water that was tepid, or the giant colony of spiders that would crawl up from the drain at any moment in time.
Also, you know, in that house, it's all coming back to me. In that
the house, toilet.
No, in that house, I had one towel, but I also had to be very careful to have something else so I could put it down to step out of the shower and onto that little hand towel to use as like a bath mat. Because if not, you get like the athlete's feet or whatever, right? So it was constantly trying to pick up that towel. Because if you were lazy, that towel would get all cruddy or whatever, and you couldn't use that anymore. It's like, and then I got to go in and do like some sort of covert mission when Dad's not in the house to go and get another towel to replace it. He kept the towels next to his bedroom door.
He cut out holes in the wall and the ceiling to create a laundry chute so he could throw his towels directly down to right above the laundry room instead of having to collect them upstairs.
If he could have had that chute go into our bathroom so we'd have to use this.
Like cast-offs?
Yes.
Second run towels.
It did go through your bathroom.
But he's saying that into our bathroom, so then they were in our rotation for you.
To be used by us.
Yeah.
That might have been the original design.
I just remember having to be careful about when we flushed the toilet downstairs, because it would cause havoc.
Oh, yeah. You'd have to time your number twos. Okay.
We're all very clearly traumatized. Shit, we need to write a book, man.
Oh. Okay, it'll be somebody else kidding.
I can't top that shit. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
You win.
There's no following the towel
shaming.
So take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we gon' leave it right here.
Take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we gon' leave it right here.
One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you wanna catch an episode. They talk movies, they go off on a tangent flow. And maybe rambling, that's the Brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open in that case. We got Eric, Drew, and Brother J. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey.
Not in a creepy way. 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 Okay. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. We got Eric, Drew, and Brother J. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey.